Hello, and welcome to episode number 72 of the Point of Convergence podcast. As always, I am your host, Exoacademian. If there's one thing that becomes abundantly clear to those who endeavor to study the so-called UFO phenomenon closely, it's that it defies easy categorization. When you come across a researcher or enthusiast who claims they've made quick work of exactly what's going on, i.e. who's involved, where they're from, what their agenda is, etc., you can be sure that their conclusions have more to do with their own wish fulfillment than with the data at hand. That isn't to say there aren't distinctive patterns that emerge within the totality of human experience with these various non-human others, giving clues as to the underlying reality, because I believe there are. But even amongst these distinct patterns, various elements of ambiguity still inevitably bubble to the surface, resisting simple classification and description. Indeed, this ambiguity may be part and parcel of a phenomenon that involves interaction with some entities who seemingly come from domains of existence far beyond our own, where perhaps even notions like space and time manifest very differently. One of the elements where this applies is in regards to how human beings interpret the nature of their experience with these various non-human alien others, along a spectrum ranging from positive to neutral to negative. This somewhat murky picture becomes even murkier when one adds the element of time, for evidence suggests that the longer people have to reflect on the nature of their encounters, the more they begin to see their interactions in either a positive light or at least as a net neutral. To be sure, this is not always the case, but nevertheless often enough to draw our attention. Perhaps this shouldn't be surprising. After all, few human beings are either all good or all bad. Most of us are progressing along a spiral of moral development. To be sure, some are further along than others, but few are what we would describe as completely malevolent, nor the epitome of righteous love and light. It makes sense that the same would hold true for these mysterious non-human others, especially when you consider that, as I would posit, they are at the end of the day also facets of the same undivided bedrock of consciousness from which we all derive our being, a being that is not, in the most ultimate sense, divided and distinct, regardless of how these matters might appear at first blush. I already mentioned that sometimes contactees/abductees/experiencers find that their interpretation of the nature of their experience evolves over time, given the advent of further perspective. Often this comes down to letting the ontological shock wear off a little, because lest we forget, these are very often, at least initially, extremely traumatic experiences where human beings encounter strange-looking entities that they've been told their entire lives cannot possibly exist. That is not to say that trauma equals inherent negativity in terms of the intentions of these various others. It just means that the physiological and neurological reaction to the event leaves clear evidence of PTSD for any trained therapist to find clear signs of. Beyond having perspectives change over the long haul, once in a while, we find the interpretation of an experience can change almost in real time, or at least within a matter of days, to weeks, to months. That's exactly what happened in a case we're going to delve into in this episode. It involves the abduction of two teenage parents and their young infant son. Were they taken against their will? Well, that's complicated. Were they initially traumatized by the shocking nature of the experience? Yes, absolutely so. Were they also permanently transformed for the better, to the point that their underlying understanding of themselves and of reality itself was expanded? Undeniably. And here again we see the overtones of the complexity of these situations. Why are these experiences initially so ontologically shocking, even when they can ultimately prove so positively transformative? And why and how is the element of personal sovereignty and personal agency so complicated when it comes to the subject of alien contact and/or abduction accounts? These are the very matters we'll seek to engage with by delving deeply into an astonishing real-world example in this, the 72nd episode of the Point of Convergence podcast. All right, I'd like to kick off this week's episode with a couple of announcements. First of all, next week I will be speaking at an event in New York City titled An Inquiry into Anomalous Experiences and the Phenomenon. In-person tickets for that event are sold out, but live stream tickets are still available, and those who purchase those live stream tickets will also be able to watch the presentations from the event at their convenience afterwards. And my understanding is this is being professionally shot as well. Now, I will be recording an episode of Liminal Frames midweek, and that will be available next Saturday, October 8th, which is also the date of the conference. By the way, for those of you who have not yet heard about Liminal Frames, this is another podcast I do on the in-between weeks between Point of Convergence episodes, along with my co-host, Nathan. So definitely check that out. That is available on my YouTube channel, Exoacademian. And if you listen on a podcast network, it is its own designated podcast, Liminal Frames, frames spelled with a PH. And finally, thanks again to my Patreon supporters. And just to note that Patreon supporters also get access to bonusodes once a month and Ask Me Anything sessions as well. All right, on to today's topic. Now, first of all, on this podcast, I like to toggle back and forth between what I call the micro and the macro view. I've mentioned this numerous times, but some of you will be fairly new to this podcast, so I want to make that clear again. I think it's important to continue to investigate and consider the nuances of particular cases, while also pulling back to see potentially distinct patterns within the totality of the data from what I like to call the 30,000-foot view. Today, we're going to discuss a fascinating case involving a young couple and their infant son that happened in the 1970s in the area of Kansas and Colorado. This case is depicted in a book titled Promise, Secrets Revealed, by a man who's since passed on, named Richard Sigismund. Now, this is a relatively obscure book that probably very few of you have ever come across. Truth be told, the book could have used some additional editing. That said, the material within is gold. There are cases here that are not only truly mind-boggling, but they are also covered in rich detail. One thing is clear, Sigismund, the author, was a skilled researcher and a skilled hypnotherapist, trusted and often consulted by the famous J. Allen Hynek, no less. He also demonstrated an unusual degree of psychic capacity, as it turns out. But while Sigismund was gifted psychically, he was also very careful to be methodical and as unbiased as possible when working with people and in drawing his own conclusions based on the data that arose from his research. Now, this particular case does involve the methodology known as hypnotic regression. Now, people have different opinions on this. Some people are very for it, some people are very against it. Most are somewhere in between. Personally, I think it can be a very useful tool when it's used correctly. Clearly, again, J. Allen Hynek was of this opinion as well, and he thought that this particular person, Richard Sigismund, was an example of a skilled researcher who followed the correct protocols. He didn't ask leading questions, as you'll find out in the case we discuss shortly. That said, unfortunately, there are also those who have misused this particular methodology and have incorporated leading questions and have, on occasion, even taken advantage of the position of power they have over a patient. Of course, this is absolutely wrong, to be discouraged, and people who do this should be investigated, in my opinion. But as is often the case in any kind of therapy, we should not throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are some hypnotherapists who do great work, and I think it can be very helpful, especially to people who've had experiences with the UFO phenomenon, where memory blockage is often a main concern. And again, in this particular situation, Richard Sigismund, I think, is an example of the kind of therapist that does great work and has actually helped many, many people as a result. But as a caveat, if you are someone who's had an experience with the UFO phenomenon, and are thinking about actually reaching out to have hypnotic regression done, I would just caution to make sure you find someone who is reputable and has been put forward as a good example by others. Now, to be clear, this book was actually published after Richard Sigismund's death, and the book is based on his notes, and he authored most of it, but it was put together and finally published after his death, which was in April of 2018. And this is what the book says by way of bio. Quote, "With an open mind but no tolerance for turning his research into the absurd, Richard used his ability to hypnotize experiencers who were often caught in their own fear, confusion, and for the general population at the time, unbelievable stories. These people often experienced a loss of time as well as a loss of memory. He used his skills to help those who came to him, but also to discover what he could from their experiences. When Richard started writing his book, he only worked with and hypnotized people who were abducted together. He hypnotized each separately. Why? He wanted to get the experiences from each person without the influence of the other or others, to allow for the most honest information he could attain from each experiencer. Unquote. Now, as I mentioned, this case came his way by way of the famous J. Allen Hynek, and I'll pick up from when the book describes how that happened. Quote, "The day is the 4th of July, 1976. It was a little before Steven Spielberg would leave us spellbound with Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and about 6 years more before the gifted director would bring the world another wondrous fantasy, E.T. the Extraterrestrial, taking our curiosity along further, a counterpoint to the War of the Worlds. On this holiday, a group of friends gathered in the late afternoon around a picnic table by the side of my flower garden in Boulder, Colorado. The phone rings. My caller is a colleague in UFO research, the astrophysicist Allen Hynek, calling from his home in Evanston, Illinois, saying with some misgiving in his voice, 'I hope I'm not interrupting anything, it being the fourth, but Richard, I've been looking over a brief report that came in at the center the other day. It's possibly UFO related, but on the other hand, it may just be fantasy or a hoax. You know the problem. Anyway, it involves a young couple, Carol, Joe, and their baby. They live out there in Colorado, and it seems to involve amnesia, missing time, allegedly several lost hours. They claim to have been left with strange marks on their bodies and on their infant child as well. The report here says they were going home to Colorado, coming out your way from Ohio, driving at night, stopping to watch some luminous disc-shaped objects maneuvering. At this point, they claim to have lost the rest of the night. I thought it might be right up your alley if you want to look into it, what with you being out there and your background in psychology and hypnosis. But like I said, there might not be anything to it, possibly a waste of your time to pursue. What do you think?" Unquote. Now, a couple notes here. First of all, I'm glad he began by describing the situation, describing the era. This is 1976. The notion of alien abduction was still relatively unknown, certainly not like it is today. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, Sigismund was a skilled researcher, a no-nonsense researcher, even though he used some unconventional means like hypnotherapy. And one of the first things he would do is work to try to determine the credibility of the people he was working with. Quoting from the book again, quote, "My work was to gauge whether this case warranted the effort to discern a possible motive for conjuring up a tall tale. As a counselor, I had heard many initially convincing stories told by artful people," unquote. Now, in regards to this couple that he was interviewing and potentially going to work with, he said the following, quote, "To dispel this hypothesis, their story seemed quite unrehearsed. Moreover, beneath the narrative was an underlying element of fear. Something had shaken them to the core. It's hard to fabricate that kind of reaction. Nor did they appear to belong to what remained of the spaced-out psychedelic subcultures of the time, for whom reality and fantasy were often inextricably entwined. Flower children? Yes, but disarmingly rational. I saw the marks on their bodies. Some were prominent despite the passage of time, especially commanding with the long striations on Carol's back. I was told that the marks had been more vivid earlier." Unquote. Now, what's fascinating with a researcher that is objective like Sigismund, he actually goes out of his way to see if there's other possibilities, other explanations other than alien abduction. And he actually takes this couple through a series of questions to get them to consider the possibility that it might be something else entirely. This is exactly the opposite of leading questions, in my point of view. Quoting from the book again, quote, "I wanted them to consider a possibility that if we were to employ hypnosis and it revealed that nothing extraordinary happened during the time for which they could not account, could they live with that? Their sense of missing time might have been brought on by monotony, creating a kind of self-hypnosis, not an uncommon event. How did they get the strange marks on their bodies? Could it have been a shared psychological event? This was the theory entertained by Dr. Benjamin Simon early in the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. Carol interjected, "What if our minds produced all the marks and everything? Is that what you're asking?" Yes. Can you live with that possibility? I suggest that you take the question home and give it some thought. Unquote. Now, obviously, the reason I brought up that particular section of the book is to demonstrate just how objective he was attempting to be. He wanted even this couple to consider that it might have been nothing unusual whatsoever, and that there might be a prosaic explanation even for the markings on their body. That again says to me this is an objective researcher, and I can see how Hynek sought him out specifically. All right, so as it turns out, after the couple considered what he had said to them, they agreed to go into hypnosis regardless of what they found. And this is actually what ended up happening when they recalled the event. Quoting again from the book, quote, "Just before the amnesia, which seems to have happened at about 1:15 a.m., Joe and Carol left Goodland, Kansas, approaching Burlington, Colorado, driving west on Interstate I-70 in the open plains of western Kansas. Joe is driving. Carol is kidding Joe, who at the moment is not too happy about her spilling hot coffee in his lap after she handed him a paper cup she just uncapped. As this mini crisis is resolved, Joe notices his headlights flickering and fading, then coming back on again. Joe wonders what is happening to the car's electrical system. At the same time, the car's audio speakers make weird hissing sounds that threaten to shut out their tape-playing rock music. Carol shouts, 'Joe, look up out the window in the sky. Joe, look at those things. They're right up there just flying around. Wow, look, Joe.' Joe slows down. They both observe three large disc-shaped objects. They are silver with swirling orange, red, and blue-colored lights. The three discs now race toward each other while a fourth descends quickly from somewhere above. They meet in a burst of blue light. Then the one from above zooms back up into the sky while one of the original three descends and appears to land in a wooded area up ahead. A quick burst of light briefly illuminates the area. Meanwhile, a strange golden glowing dumbbell-shaped object, looking like two golden spheres connected by an equally glowing golden rod, appears. It appears to be tailing their car. It's now visible in the rear window and following them closely, accelerating and slowing as if quite determined to keep pace. Carol's initial amazement now turns to alarm. 'It's following us, Joe. It's really following us.' Joe tries to dismiss Carol's concern. Instead, he marvels at it all. 'Now, nobody can tell me there's no such thing as UFOs. Nobody.' Carol, for her part, turns to watch the two remaining discs. She is curious yet apprehensive. 'They look like the ones I saw with my mother in Ohio one time. Joe, look how they skip around the sky.' She ignores the glowing dumbbell object out the back window as she observes the other discs. Joe continues, 'Carol, just think how great it would be to go up in one of those things and see what it's like to fly around out in space. Wouldn't you like to go?' Carol replies, 'Guess I'd go, I mean, like, if the baby wasn't in the car.' They toss this theme around when they see a fleet of four more objects in the sky. Carol describes the new arrivals. They don't have the blue and orange swirling lights like the others. They're tapered, thinner on the edge, then kind of fat in the middle. They're brighter in the middle part, and there is a silvery glow on the whole outside. Joe, always the mechanic, finds himself comparing what they have been seeing with their own rather beat-up vehicle, and he finds the comparison unflattering. 'Theirs is a Ford,' he explained, 'whose electrical system had been acting up before they left Colorado, and it seems to have resisted all attempts to get fixed.' Finding the comparison increasingly unpleasant, Joe again teases his mate, 'Carol, those just got to be flying saucers, you know, UFOs. Look what they can do. Whoa, man. If they can do all that, I'll bet they could fix this damn car.' He pushes Carol for response like the 19-year-old he was, a young man with a wild imagination and a love of technology. 'Carol, what if I volunteer us as guinea pigs? I've heard they sometimes want that. I mean, if they fix the car. How about it?' Unquote. Now, I bring this particular section to your attention because, as it turns out, they do end up having interaction with the beings flying these UFOs. But again, just to clarify, Joe actually talked about them being guinea pigs. He said, perhaps jokingly, to his wife, What do you think about us going and meeting them and going for a ride in space in one of those UFOs? As it turns out, that's exactly what ends up happening. But again, when we think about the issue of sovereignty and agency, in all fairness, we just want to bring to your attention here that they actually talked about this happening before it actually happened, before they had the experience with missing time. I also want to bring to your attention, although it might have skipped past you without you noticing, that Carol actually mentions here that they looked like the ones she once saw one time with her mother in Ohio. Now, I would say that's very key, because often what we find is people who do have experiences with the phenomenon, with the beings that actually end up contacting them, they find that actually the memories stretch back further than they initially realized. Often only later do they realize that they have memories going back to much earlier in life. And so it's interesting that, again, here we find that's the case, that even though this is the situation that really draws all the attention, Carol has memories of seeing these even before then, which again sometimes hints to a lifetime connection. Now let's jump back into the book where they last remember something and then suddenly find themselves much further down the road with hours of missing time. Quote, Joe finds a place to pull off the highway, opens the car door, and sits up on the hood. He watches the golden glowing dumbbell-shaped craft. It too has stopped and hovers low and just a little behind them. The rest of the aerial assembly seems to have gone. At this point, Joe and Carol's conscious memory abruptly ends. I learn that their story picks up some 4 hours later, 150 miles further west. Unquote. And from here, we're going to pick up with Carol's initial hypnotic regression. And this is very, very telling. It goes into what happens during those 4 hours of missing time. Quoting from the book again, quote, I ask, where are you, Carol? I'm standing in the doorway of something. It's like a big round thing. It's silvery. It's really big. Some sort of ship, I think. I go up and up and up and up these steps. There's a landing. The steps turn and go up and up more. They're silvery too, metal. That's how I got up in this big doorway. It's bright and there are lights going around and around and around on the bottom of the ship. If that's what it is, I guess it's a ship. And there are colors. They're real bright. And that's on the bottom of the ship and it goes round real fast. Carol now becomes silent and for a long time will not respond to questions. Seeking to break this resistance, I ask her her potentially emotionally loaded question. Carol, do you know where Joe is and your baby? Slowly, as if disconnected and lost, Carol replies, I don't know. He was just ahead of me. I followed him up and up the stairs. And Mickey? I don't know. Her voice trails off. I ask again about her baby. She ignores the question. I try another approach. Carol, I inquire, tell me how you got to the ship. Describe what you and Joe were doing, if you can, before you went up the stairs. Carol replies, but in a dull monotone. She relates that they went off the road somewhere on down a way and then cut across the fields for about 10 minutes following a strange-looking flying device that looked like two golden spheres connected by a glowing rod. They drove until they came to some woods, then went through an opening in the woods, leading them to a big open area. Here was the ship, Carol says. We cut across the fields at an angle. We go on and on. Why do you do this? I ask, and she replies that she does not know why Joe is doing this. Does it bother you? I ask. I don't feel anything. I'm sort of worried, but I don't feel anything. We're coming to the woods. Then tell me, what do you do when you approach the woods? We go through this little opening, stopping the car, then taking off our seatbelts. I'm wondering what the heck is going on. We cross over this little stream, and then we start walking up the steps. And I see the lights going round, fast, around the bottom of the ship. We walk on through the door and are at the top of the stairs. Tell me what you see when you walk in the door, if you see anything. When I walk through the door, there's a lot of computer-like things around. They're on the walls to my right and to my left, but there are none in front of me. The walls, bend a little. What makes you think these things are computers? Can you describe them? There are these little lights that flicker off and on all over the place. There's a screen. There's a big window above the computer. Unquote. Now, clearly already at this point, we see that they are to some extent being led. They are being sent telepathic signals that makes them do certain things. That even she says they're doing a certain thing, but she doesn't know why they're doing it. They just seem to be following some sort of telepathic impulse being sent by these others. And that becomes even clearer as the story proceeds. Quoting again from the book, quote, "Then she adds, I'm walking into another room, as if she has experienced a motor response, herself walking, prior to any thought. Why are you doing this? I don't know. Oh, now I know. Because they told me to. Who told you? I inquire. I don't know. I haven't seen him yet. It was all suddenly just in my head to go, like ESP or something. They just told me to go down the hallway, go to the third room on the left with the lights on. There are other rooms off the hallway, but I can't see into them because they're all dark. Are you in the room yet, Carol? What do you see? Yes, there's just a little table with lights above it and a door off on the side in the room. But I can't see where it goes to because it's so dark except for the lights above the table. There's a window. It's just black with no light coming from it. Now I'm getting up on the table. Now I'm laying on the table. Why are you getting up on the table and then lying on it? I guess they told me to, again, like, to do it. An idea that just popped into my head. Go lie on the table. Like, I know they said something to me, but I couldn't hear it with my ears or anything, but in my mind. I know they said it." Unquote. Now, what's interesting here is Carol is in real time experiencing how strange it is that she's doing things based on these commands, these ideas that are just popping into her mind. Now, in this show, we're very familiar with the telepathic communication that happens, and even the impulse control, the consciousness control some of these others wield over human beings. But this was in the 1970s. None of that was really understood at this point. And you can see in real time how Carol is shocked by her own behavior as it replays in her mind in the midst of this hypnotic regression. Now, this ability they apparently wield to control our very experience of reality continues to be on display in what happens next. Quoting from the book again, quote, "What is happening now, Carol? Tell me, if you are able. I'm still laying on the table, but I can't see anything now. It's dark. I can see a shadow over by the door because there's a dim light coming out through the other room. It's just standing there." And to my next question, "What or who is just standing there?" There is no response. The question is repeated, but still no response. Something about the question seems to disturb her. She tenses up. I change direction, asking, "How do you feel?" Surprisingly, she says, "I feel relaxed, real good. I'm getting off the table now and walking out of the room into this other room. It's a real, real dark room." Again, Carol's movements as well as her mood seem controlled by a distant telepathic command. As more time passes, she seems to gain more command of herself. She notes that the room has suddenly become light, but she can't detect the source. She begins to wonder where her baby is, but it is as if the thought just begins to form, then seems to get disconnected from an emotional response. And while she still is in this disjointed consciousness, she walks about the room, seemingly calm, casually observing some furnishings, like a low, couch-like table, nothing else, much like the examination room. After time, she begins to wonder, in the same detached, offhand way, what are they going to do next? Her mood shifts once more. She suddenly becomes very tense. Her breathing changes to a series of short gasps. Her fists clench and her whole body tightens rigidly. Then, as if long-suppressed emotions break, she cries out, "I'm scared! I'm really scared! I want to go home! Home!" Her voice becomes one long sob and she continues, "I want to go home! I want to run! I want to get out of here! I've got to get out of here! Oh my God! I want to go home!" And with her emotions apparently now integrated into her awakened consciousness, she remembers amazingly that she has a 3.5-month-old baby and that she has been separated from this child for quite some time. She has no idea where he is nor his condition. Apparently, her maternal instinct has returned. "I want my baby. I want my Mickey," she cries out as if with sudden awareness that her child and her husband are gone. Now, at this point, I'm sure if we were to put ourselves in her shoes, we can understand her concern. We can understand her terror. She suddenly realizes she's alone in this strange craft, and she doesn't know where her husband nor her young baby is. You can understand this would be a very concerning situation. But as it turns out, the situation then changes again when these beings bring her baby back to her. Quoting from the book again, quote, "Oh God, someone is coming in the room. Oh God, oh God, just look at it. Just let it be human. Just let it be human. I see it, and it's got arms and legs like a person, got a head like a person. It's got something over its head. Ugly. Ugh, yuck. Brown, bubbly skin, a suit. Oh God, let it be human. But whatever it is, it can't be all bad. Can't be. It can't be because he's got Mickey with him. He's got my baby. It can't be that bad because he's handing me Mickey. He's given me Mickey. I've got Mickey. I've got him, she shouts. I've got him. Unquote. Now, in this particular situation, two things we should make note of. Number one, quickly her concerns are alleviated when they give her back her child and he seems no worse for the wear. But in the midst of that, we also see her ontological shock on clear display when she notices this being and notices it's clearly not human, and she initially has that visceral negative reaction just because of the way it looks. Now, related to this, I recently engaged in a conversation on social media where I discussed this very thing, this very contradiction in the way we talk about the way they look. And quoting from what I wrote on social media, quote, "We humans are often highly suspicious of the alien beings who use screen memories to hide their true appearance from us. That said, when shown what they actually look like, we often respond with evolutionarily derived abject terror," unquote. Now, a couple points here. One, I'm making the point that you can see to some degree how these others may be caught between a rock and a hard place because they are accused of being underhanded in not showing us their true appearance, when on the other hand, when they do show us what they actually look like, we respond with evolutionarily derived abject terror. So they kind of can't win either way. Now, I want to point out that I said they're evolutionarily derived. And I made that point because people can be generally non-prejudiced and still respond with fright in these situations. Responding with fear here doesn't make them bad people. It just means that we should acknowledge that our response isn't necessarily tied to inherent danger at hand. Again, it's an evolutionary response. Now, I've heard some people on the social media thread say, well, I wouldn't respond that way. I would be very welcoming. And I say, maybe. But again, because this is evolutionarily derived, we don't necessarily have initial conscious control over our response. Think about how you respond to a spider. Is that rational? Is it based on actual danger at hand? Now, that said, people can learn through desensitization techniques to become less afraid of spiders. But again, when people first encounter these others that look very different and often look like giant bugs, giant insectoid beings, they haven't had the chance to be desensitized. This happens all in one go, and it's a massive ontological shock. Now, getting back to Carol's experience, again, she's been given back her baby. He seems no worse for the wear. And remember earlier on that Joe talked about how amazing it would be if they could go for a flight in space. Well, check out what happens next. Going back to Carol's experience, quote, "It's getting dark in the room too. Oh, there's a window," she then remarks as if very surprised, as if it wasn't there before. I ask, "Carol, can you see out the window?" "Yes, I see these lights flashing by. My stomach feels kind of fluttery. The window light is coming in and then it goes away, comes back, goes away. I think it's the stars that are doing that," she says with great surprise in her voice. I just can't believe it. A tone of the awesome and the incredulous now fills her voice. "I think I'm flying. It really seems like we're moving. It's really great." Later, we determine that the craft has been spinning while ascending, giving the illusion that the stars are moving. Then her voice changes to puzzlement. "It's now black out there, just black. It's real black now out there. I don't know. Oh, I can't believe it. I think I'm flying," she shouts again. Then abruptly, "Oh, I'm looking down." Carol is crying softly now. Her breath is labored. Tears stream copiously down her cheeks. In short gasps of breath, she struggles to speak. I ask her to try to describe what she is looking at. "Earth! Earth!" she cries out. "It's beautiful. I'm looking down at Earth. Oh God, it's so beautiful," unquote. Now soon Carol receives another telepathic communication, though this isn't a command to go into a certain room. Instead, she learns that they mean well. This is what they tell her through the telepathic communication. Quoting from the book, quote, "Now she seems to have received another telepathic communication. This one tells her that they were not going to hurt her. It's like they just told me in my head that they weren't going to hurt me, that they were good, and they didn't want to hurt me, unquote. And then later, she actually sees them playing with her child. And this, again, makes her feel much more at ease than she was. Quote, she smiles. She begins to laugh, then chuckles loudly. I don't know how to say it, but it looks like they're just bouncing Mickey. I don't know. It just looks like they're playing with him. There are two of them standing there playing with him. Oh gosh, that looks so funny. Mickey, he's just laughing. They look like they're just having fun, she laughs. They're still playing with him. I don't believe it. Just bouncing him around. They must have played with him the whole time. Unquote. Now, this was Carol's experience. What was happening with Joe this entire time? We now jump to his experience, as was recalled in the hypnotic regression. Quote, with Carol asleep, Joe is led into what Carol calls the computer room, perhaps the command center of the ship. Apparently, it is the very room with the large doorway to the outside and the stairs that lead to the ground. Joe has been separated from Carol and has been subjected to a different kind of examination, about which we know very little. Joe seems to have been under full anesthesia much of the time, but we know that his knees are swollen as a result, making walking difficult. At the present time, he is steadied by one of the entities who leads him into the so-called computer room. Again, this is the room with the big doorway to the outside. The door is now open. The entity now turns to face Joe. Joe sees a bright spiral of energy beginning to form in the space between them. The spinning energy gets larger and larger, eventually surrounding both Joe and the entity itself. Then, seeming to reverse, the spiral pulls Joe out of his body, apparently doing the same to the entity. Here we are led to believe they are now between their respective physical bodies, where they now meet and join. Joe describes the scene, crying out, "He's pulling me out! I'm out! I'm two, but I'm one! There is an energy coming from him. It's a light. There is a spiral of energy, a bright light forming between us like a pinwheel spinning. It all turns towards the center. The energy spirals and spins, and it's drawing me out of my body. My body is behind me. I have another body now, but how can that be?" After the outburst, Joe falls silent as if now asleep. After a time, I ask him if he is able to speak. He continues in what seems like a maze of speechless bewilderment. "It's just like our two minds meet, but not meet like in our heads. It's like we both separate from our bodies and meet in the center of this spinning spiral of energy between us." I ask Joe if he knows why this is happening to him. He replies, "The entity is doing this because he says he's doing this because he wants me to know him, to know what he's really like before we go, before we leave the ship. He wants me to truly know him," he says. Joe pauses a long time to gather his words. "It's like there is one ball of energy now and both of us are in it. We're in this ball of energy, but my body is behind me. I just floated out." Joe's voice is quivering with emotion and he is close to crying. To the observer, it seems that he is overcome with awe and disbelief, as if what is happening to him is at both very real and equally incomprehensible. Joe's face takes on a look of total peace and serenity, and tears begin to slowly form and fall from his cheeks. Trying to get a better sense of what Joe is experiencing in this apparent out-of-the-body experience, I ask Joe, "Where are you? I mean, in your mind, where are you? Or if there's a better way to express yourself in your emotions, how do you feel?" Joe, lying on a couch in my study with eyes closed, still in a deep hypnotic sleep, slowly responds. He begins with a deep and prolonged sigh, yet the ecstatic look remains on his face. "Like I never want to let it go. I want to never let it go." And after another long pause, he continues, "I feel warm, real carefree, happy, peaceful. Seems like our two parts make one. Feels like I could just... Joe's voice drifts off, then continues after another long silence, during which he seems to have been immersed in the experience. "He drew me out of my body. We meet between our bodies in the same ball of energy between us. Just one ball and we both are in it. And it somehow feels like I could just float away, leave my body there, just leave it standing behind me." Seeking to further probe the event, still hoping to gain a better feel for the psychology of it, my questioning continues. "Can you still feel yourself when you're in this ball of energy? Or have you sort of melted into the ball of energy? Describe it if you still have your full sense of self." "It's kind of like I can feel both. but it's more like just one person, he and I. Then I ask, Joe, can you see what's around you while in your present situation? I can see everything, but it seems like it doesn't matter. I can see outside the ship, me, him, the stairs from the ship going down. You say you can see you? Where are you? I'm kind of in two places at once. When I ask Joe to tell me more about it, he answers, my body is standing there, but the power to move, it's away from it. Seems like I am part of him now. Returning to Joe later on, I ask if the OBE has given him any insight into the basic nature, the inner makeup of the alien being, especially given that the entity seemed truly wanting Joe to know what he is really like. Are they like us, Joe, or are they different? They're like us, but different, he responds quickly, and this is hardly more enlightening. In what way are they different? Joe now very slowly replies, they don't seem to have bad qualities. What makes you feel they have no bad qualities, Joe? How can you tell? I can just feel it. They just seem so peaceful. I can feel it. I can feel what they're like. Unquote. Now, in that last section I read from there, you will notice that Joe mentioned seeing the stairs of the craft. That's because they are now back on the ground. And soon, Joe is reunited with Carol and the baby. And then Joe watches as they very carefully return them all to the car. Now, at that point, Joe starts driving away until he is overcome with fatigue and decides to take a nap. During this whole time, it seems like a certain craft, a ball of light, stays over the car while they are resting. When they wake up and drive away, this craft stays with them until they are back on the highway, and only then does it depart. And here we come to the point where they suddenly have conscious recall, being 150 miles down the road with 4 hours of missing time. And what we just described is exactly what happened, according to this hypnotic regression, during those missing 4 hours. Now, one interesting question to always ask about these kinds of scenarios is how were people changed by it? What was the long-term impact of this kind of encounter? This is what Carol's response was to that question. Quote, Carol, taking the initiative, is the first to reply. Yes, I think now more than I used to, and now I am much more aware of the world than I used to be. For example, I'm more outward, like it's not just me. There are millions of people around me who have the same dreams I have. I'm more aware of that now. And another thing, I just don't let people take advantage of me like I used to. Since the experience, I am not as passive as I used to be. I'm much more responsive and assertive. I stand up and give my opinion more often. Now, I open my mouth when I disagree with people more than ever I used to. Yes, I can speak up more. Unquote. And when the therapist asks Joe how he's been changed, he says, quote, I can like people easier than I could before. I didn't like too many people before, just very few people. Also, I'm not so fearful of people as before. Or if I'm poor and my neighbor is rich, it don't matter to me anymore. Unquote. And by the way, soon after that, in the dialogue, Joe goes on to say he feels closer to God after this experience and doesn't fear death like he did before and doesn't think about hell despite what he was taught growing up in a fundamentalist family. That the experience with this being during this out-of-body experience made him feel very comfortable about the depth and breadth of what reality and life truly is about. So I think you'll agree this is a truly astonishing case that has a little bit of everything. And I'll leave you with these concluding thoughts. What cases like this do is complicate our simple one-dimensional narratives about what's going on with the UFO phenomenon. Some people see the actions of one group parading around in different guises. Others see different groups, but would like to lump them into the binary categories of the goods and the bads, clean polarities all the way up and all the way down. Often, though, as with other aspects of life, the picture is more complicated. The lack of human sovereignty is an issue often raised by those who see these others as taking us against our will. And to some degree, that happens here. Though, if you remember, Joe actually talked about offering themselves up as guinea pigs, as it were, before the quote-unquote abduction actually took place. That isn't to say this is always the case with people, but it was here. We also see in this case, like in so many others, clear signs of consciousness control. They can seemingly beam commands into our minds that we seem largely unable to resist. often only being able to see that it did not originate with us to begin with after the fact. And of course, we see here that they also enable a true transformation in consciousness that, as is often the case, at the end of the day, the contactees end up feeling appreciative of. In Joe's case, the out-of-body experience he experienced was so profound that it took away his fear of death, helped him see that he was not fully distinct and separate from others, even when those others were apparently alien. These kinds of events are no doubt complex. While these others do often seem to mean well, and often even end up healing people in these interactions, they also seem to be lacking in the fullness of understanding as to what they could do to put us more at ease to begin with. In other words, there seems to be a lack of understanding of human nature. And perhaps this shouldn't surprise us. For rather than being the one-dimensional angels and demons that some paint them to be, what we see in their actions are signs that they are mortal beings like us. These particular ones, anyway, well-meaning and more evolved in many ways, but also imperfect and still evolving. And this mixed bag, I would suggest, is exactly what we would expect to find if what we are interacting with are conscious agents, to use a Donald Hoffman phrase, who are, like us, walking out an experience of individuality and relative finiteness, but who are also, underlyingly, just like us, part of the undivided bedrock of consciousness that has spawned all of the wondrous complexity we find present in our diverse, multidimensional, and richly populated cosmos. And on that note, we've come to the close of another edition of the Point of Convergence podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast, you can do so by going to patreon.com/exoacademian. But until next time, friends, from deep within the Blue Ridge Mountains of North Carolina, this is Exo Academian signing out.